Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Vicki Winterton, founder of Expert Insights Family of Opportunity, home of Expert Insights Publishing, award-winning magazine, books, broadcasts, and global communities. And I am thrilled today because with me I have the wonderful author, J.R. Langford. Jamie, in the 1990s, quit her former job, which involved getting around the world to oversee the development of world standards for electrical products, to pursue a childhood dream of writing novels. She is the acclaimed author of The Jesus Thief, the series which consists of The Jesus Thief, The Secret Madonna, and The Sacred Imposter, about an attempt to clothe Jesus of Nazareth using DNA stolen from the Shroud of Turin. Lauded by pioneering cloning scientist, the late Robert F. Foote of Cornell, and by Booklist in a star review, the series has twice been opted for film translation rights to all three books recently sold to major Portuguese, Russian, and Turkish publishers. A fourth book in the series, The Convert Messiah, is underway. She has written one murder mystery, Murder Without Motive, and many, many other accolades to Jamie's writing skills as well as her contribution to the world. So I am so thrilled to have you with us, Jamie. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me and for that very kind introduction.
Well, I'd love to hear more about the series that you've written and also what inspired you to write The Jesus Thief.
Well, I'm an electrical engineer. And so is my husband. And we've always, we like to keep up with science, whatever the developments are. And one day I learned that there actually is type AB male blood on the Shroud of Turin, which is supposedly the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. It's that long cloth owned by the Vatican that has the imprint of a man, apparently a crucified man, on front and back. Well, when I learned there really was this rare blood on it, because that blood type is not common in Europe and the West, but it's very common in Jerusalem. And then when I learned a scientist actually did PCR replication, unauthorized, of course, on the DNA, it just blew my mind. And so I was off and running with this novel. The basic premise is that a scientist steals some of that DNA from the Shroud of Turin, smuggles it back into New York, and tries to clone Jesus. And that premise has allowed me to explore science and belief, which is another of my passions, you know, what we do because of what we believe. And it's allowed me to introduce all kinds of characters to the story and take them all over the world. And so I'm now traveling in my mind, in my books, instead of, you know, for my work as I used to do.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, you know, you're an author and also an engineer. So tell us a little bit about what science has to say about the Shroud and the DNA.
Well, just really amazing things. I'll tell you, when I wanted to do justice to this subject, even though it's a novel, these are novels, and I did a great deal of research. When I first looked into it, what shocked me was that this is, you know, the doubters say that this is a fake created, you know, our first record of the Shroud is from 1392, I think it is, or somewhere right in that period. And I'm thinking, well, in 1392, it ought to be absolutely easy to prove something created in that period is a fake, because they certainly did not have the technology to produce what we're seeing when we just look at the Shroud. And so all of the tests, they were not conclusive. And that by itself, to me, was highly interesting. Just last week, about a week ago, an Italian scientist, well, a group of scientists working at the University of Padua in Italy, have made the announcement that they have concluded the Shroud is not a fake. And I'll tell you, I came to that conclusion, too. It's just unbelievable that anybody in the 1300s could produce what is in effect a high radiation photograph made on the surface of a cloth. That technology just didn't exist then. So now, proving the reverse is impossible. We can, you know, we can say, I think, authoritatively that the Shroud isn't something that somebody produced for the purpose of fooling people. What we can't say, what science can't say, is it definitely the Shroud of Jesus of Nazareth? because to say that, you would have to have, you know, his DNA to compare to someone we know is a relative. That's the only way science could prove that. And so that will never happen. But what we know is startling enough.
That's so interesting. So this 2,000-year-old genetic material in the shroud, is it viable for a sample for cloning in real life? And human cloning becomes possible. Is it far-fetched to think we could clone Christ?
Well, I have no doubt, zero doubt, that if it were possible, someone would do it and someone would try it. There is not a complete DNA strand. The DNA that's been retrieved is very degraded. So with today's technology, it's impossible. But tomorrow's technology, who knows? Because I think we share 99.6% of our DNA with, who's our closest relative, chimpanzees. So very small percentage of the DNA strand goes into making us human, and even less goes into making us individuals. So who knows where science will go tomorrow. But one of the things that concerned me is that there are two now very serious ongoing attempts to clone humans, both living and dead. And they're not occurring in the U.S. The U.S., we got so excited about it and that we basically drove these people out of the country. But they're underway. And so I have no doubt that human cloning will occur. And this is something society will have to deal with. You know, maybe we will have a cloned Einstein to deal with one day. So I wrote the novel in such a way that when you read it without even noticing, you learn what cloning is, you know, scientifically, and the issues that surround it, you know, in hopes that it will help us, you know, when that time comes, if it isn't here already and we just don't know it yet.
Well, tell me what your viewpoint is on if Jesus could be cloned, should he be, and what the Bible says about cloning.
Well, that's interesting. It doesn't say anything directly about cloning, but in a way, the original Jesus, some say, was the first clone because Mary's egg was fertilized miraculously, but from a source external to her, which is what cloning is in principle. So, of course, my personal opinion is that this shouldn't happen. But, of course, what an interesting concept to me. I mean, if it could happen, if it did happen, why would somebody do it? Who would carry the child? Because, you know, clones need mothers. And how would the world react? Would it be any different than the first time Jesus was here? So all of these things I explore in the novel, and it was just tremendous, you know, fun and a wonderful experience, really, to do all the research for it. I wanted everything to be authentic, you know, everything else but the premise. So I went, most of it takes place in New York, New York area, and some in Italy, so I went there. And I met the most wonderful people. All the locations are authentic. The backgrounds of the characters are real. For instance, my mad scientist, Felix Rossi, he's a brilliant guy, a devout Catholic, and examining the Shroud of Turin in person was his lifelong dream. But he finds out when his dream is about to come true, the book opens in Turin, as he's about to examine the shroud, gets a call from his sister in New York and learns their parents, were really Jews to escape Nazi Italy. And this throws him into turmoil. Well, what gave me the idea for this was the story of, well, a news story I read of a real priest who discovered his parents were Jews. He was Polish, and they gave him away to a Christian couple when they were fleeing the Nazis. And so, you know, it gave me the chance to explore, well, what happened during World War II with the Nazis. In fact, Italy's 90% or more, could be 95%, of Italy's Jews survived the Nazis, and it was because of the Italians. And so I went to Italy to find out why, and I put it in the book. And so I do that with all of the characters. There's something, you know, the woman who carries the clone, you know, why would she do it? I ask myself, who would she be? And so I use each character to explore something that I found interesting and that reveals, you know, who we are as human beings.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I have to say, you know, you have this unbelievable, groundbreaking career as an engineer, and you belong to Mensa and Tops. You have an incredibly high IQ. What do you think is the most important thing that made you a great writer? Was it those things, or was it something else that is maybe more important than IQ, especially for our budding authors out there that may be listening?
Well, I don't know. First of all, you have to write well, I believe. You have to love what you're writing about. You have to love people, even your villains. If you can't connect to them as human beings, I feel you can't write a compelling story. So for me, and of course, since we're talking books, you have to love words and have a facility with them. That's what got me going on this track. I read my way through my childhood. And when I was 11, I discovered a French author, Colette, and just fell in love with the words. I would stop and reread sentences over and over. They were so beautiful. And so I didn't see a path to writing because I knew you had to understand people. I certainly didn't when I was 11. So instead, I became an engineer, and because I wanted to understand the physical world, having read my way through the first part of my life. And then I took my yearning for the world that I got from reading books. I read about everything, you know, everywhere. And I traveled, you know, had that international career, which allowed me to travel. And so, but the stories were in me, and I left that work with just a passion to write what I'd experienced and what I'd seen. So what an author needs is a passion. You have to love something that you're writing about, because writing is a solitary profession. It takes discipline to do it. So I think my engineering helped there. It certainly helped me with constructing plots. But the thing to realize, the thing I learned, if I were going to tell a young writer, is to realize that you must make fictional people like real people. And one thing that I've noticed new writers tend to miss is the importance of intention, or a character's intention or goal, long-term goal, and their what they plan to do in the next 5 minutes. It's really the drumbeat of life, and we don't even notice it because we do it all the time. I mean, you and I formed an intention to meet, you know, 15 minutes ago, and so here we are. And so for a writer, for a novelist, the key thing is to share the character's intention with the reader. Then we want to know what happened. We'll turn the page to see what happened. That's what happened in real life. I mean, we start the day, we tell each other, we say, what are your plans? And you share them, and then at the end, they say, you want to know what happened. So that's how it is in real life, and that's important in books. So intention. And another important key to writing a successful novel is the concept is called scene and sequel, that life unfolds in events and reaction to events. So a writer who can get that drumbeat going, this happened, and this is how he reacted, and this is what he's going to do, plans to do next, the intention, then you've got the basics of story, along with one other element, and that element is trouble. We are trouble junkies. People are, and readers are. And I thought about this for a long time until I figured out why. Trouble means something has changed. We notice a change in the environment. We notice when something different happens. Our whole species is geared to notice anything that's different, anything that's new, in case it's a threat. That's how we survived, you know, in our, you know, caves and jungles when we started out. We're alert to a change in our surroundings. So if you want to get a reader interested, let them know that something has changed for the character. And they call that in books the inciting incident. Let some trouble show up early on and keep the character in pursuit of resolving that trouble. Mm. So that's what I found.
Those are such important points. And definitely your intention and your passion has been so strong in that you've written three books in the series, The Jesus Thief, The Secret Madonna, and also the recently published The Sacred Imposter. Why did you decide to continue the story? What was there for you?
Well, I didn't at first know it was going to be a series. With The Jesus Thief, an agent suggested that I kind of truncate it, and which created a bit of a cliffhanger. And after a while, the characters just, they wanted their story told. They were so strong in my mind. They wake me in the night, you know. And I'd find myself at my computer writing about them. And so this continued. And the inspiration was just overwhelming for each novel. In the second book, that takes place mostly in Italy, which I fell in love with Northern Italy when I was there. I'd been there before, but I hadn't, you know, for work, not at a leisurely pace. And so, and I wanted to just show, take the reader there so they could experience it. And in the second book, I'll give it away. The first book ends with the birth of the clone. In the second book, we're in Italy with this mysterious 10-year-old boy and his mother, and the world is in pursuit of him. And so there's this child, you know, and I'm thinking, okay, now would he be like Jesus? Would he have the consciousness and identity of Jesus? So I explore that. And then in book three, I take the characters to Mexico. I live in Texas, and not too far from me is the whole country, our closest southern neighbor, and most Americans, I think, know very little about it. And so I wanted to bring that into the book because that is such an important country to us, and there are many Mexican-Americans here in the country. And so my idea is that the more information you have about anybody, the better off things will be. And also I became fascinated with what I discovered in my research about Mexico. I mean, I was shocked to see that all the records from the conquest when I started to say Vasco da Gama, but that's another book I'm thinking about. When, oh my goodness, what's his name? I'm having a brain blip. Who conquered Mexico? Okay, it'll come to me in a second. But at any rate, when he came here, the Spanish came here and conquered Mexico City, that was the Aztec capital at the time. The records from that are online. The original diaries of the Spanish and from the Aztecs are some of the Aztecs. The records that survive are online, and it's absolutely riveting. So I was gone when I read that. I just researched the history of Mexico all the way up to today, what the issues were, and just put the Virgin of Guadalupe tradition in that novel. And I just love the current, there's something called curanderismo. It is the Mexican, it's an ancient tradition of healing, Mexico's healing art. So there is a character in the novel who is a curanderismo. And, of course, I dealt with, you know, some of the issues of the day, what's called so-called illegal immigration, you know, what prompts someone to leave their country and come here, want to come here, and what are the different viewpoints about it. You know, in my novels, I don't try to pose, give solutions or preach about anything, including religion, but I do try to authentically represent, you know, what is, how people are, what's happening, how we feel, what we believe, and what we do. And that makes it just a joy for me.
Yeah, I have to say, your vivid descriptions of Mexico are a joy for me because I live in Mexico 8 months out of the year. We live in Montanilla. That's where I'm speaking to you from now. And it is like such an incredible culture. And again, you created such vivid descriptions that I personally experience every day. Tell me a little bit more about how you did that so effectively.
Well, I have not traveled in Mexico as much as I've traveled in other parts of the world, but I did a great deal of research. And of course, the internet has photographs of everything online, and I was shocked. You can actually walk down a Mexican street in Mexico on, what's it called, Google Earth or something.
Right.
Yeah, so I took advantage of every tool that was available, and I have even still sitting behind me a pile of books that I read about Mexico because I do want to, when I write about a place or about a people, try to authentically depict it so the readers, you know, can experience it, you know, as it is, you know, as much as possible. So, and I'm very glad to hear that from you, you know. I wrote this book in 2005, and I was so conscious of the fact that I'm not Mexican and don't speak Spanish that I was reluctant to put it out. And so I had a few Mexican people read it, you know, I think two, but I still didn't have confidence. Finally, I met a young man who was born in Mexico City and speaks Spanish, and he went through it you know, page by page with me and told me, he says, there are almost no mistakes. And he, you know, told me how to fix them. And he said, you really shouldn't, you know. He encouraged me. His encouragement made me get the book out. So I felt, okay, time to go.
Oh, that is so fantastic. I'm so glad you did. And, you know, in a world where blacks and whites live together somewhat peacefully, many people still show animosity toward Mexican immigrants or express fear of Muslims. What do you tell those people after all the research and all of your travels?
Well, the one thing that I know from my travels for sure is absolutely how alike people are. We may appear different on the surface. We may speak a different language, dress differently, have different clothes. But when you scratch that surface, people are so alike. And that is what I'm trying to convey in all of my books. You know, my advice is to just skip the fear and go straight to the friendship, because that's what's going to happen. When two groups come into contact, they're going to end up friends. I mean, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we were at war with Japan. Now, everybody's eating sushi. So it's going to happen. We were at war with Vietnam. Now everyone's traveling there. They're over here. You know, it's going to happen. It's human nature. Just skip the fear. It's going to be okay. We're going to get along. We're going to work it out. And that's what's going to happen with Mexican with what they call illegal immigrants. I don't know what the answer is, but I know it's going to work out.
So what is your opinion on Obama's immigration reform plan with that in mind?
I don't know if anything is ever going to come out of that Congress again. Fingers crossed. I understand. Now, I'm not up to date on the very latest, but I know that they are working on it. And I think they've come up with a resolution on in terms of the, what's called the DREAM Act. And that is where, you know, they don't, children who were either who were brought here as infants, never been anywhere else, don't speak another language except English. The idea of deporting them to me is just, you know, ridiculous, you know. They've never been anywhere else. They don't know anywhere else. So I think that's pretty much agreed. I know they're working towards a what they call a path to citizenship, but the last I heard, it sounds so convoluted. So I think all we can do is just, you know, hope for the best. It's not an easy solution, you know.
Yeah.
There are 11 million Mexican people of Mexican origin in the United States that they say who aren't documented. And if that's the case, I'd like to know the person. Raise your hand who's got the answer.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a complex one, to be sure. Well, you have achieved something that a lot of writers dream of, or soon-to-be writers that are on their path, and that's that the Jesus Thief series has been opted for film twice. And tell us a little bit about how that happened for you, and also if you think Hollywood may ever make a movie based on your series.
I would absolutely love it, because The Jesus Thief came to me. The inspiration actually came to me like I saw it as scenes in my mind, as if a movie was playing in my mind. And so when I was writing it, I cast the parts, you know. I didn't know anyone in Hollywood, and I was just at home having fun. So Russell Crowe was my Sam, and Alfre Woodard was my Maggie in my mind. Well, a few weeks after I finished that first novel, a brother of mine was in New York at a function, and lo and behold, across the room, there was Alfre Woodard, the actress who I pictured playing Maggie in the novel. And he went up to her, because he's a bold guy. You know, I probably wouldn't have. But he went up to her and said, my sister's written this book, and she thinks it would make a great movie, and you would be a great Maggie, whatever he said. And so she said, well, tell her to send it to me. And I did, and beat her home. And I think it was 8 days later she was on the phone, and I could not believe it, wanting to option the rights to the novel to try to make a film. Of course, now, for anybody, including Steven Spielberg, actually getting a film made is a tough thing. It can take years and years. But, you know, for an author, having your book optioned, I mean, that almost never happened. Well, she tried, and it didn't work out. Well, I won't tell that story. I'll save this story for another day. But it didn't work out. And then last year, a second Hollywood producer just came to me out of the clear blue and said, are the rights available? I said, yes, they are. And so he tried it. And I just hope it happens one day, because it just feels like that's how I first saw it in my mind.
Oh, that is amazing. And really envisioning it is a big part of making it happen. So you've done that so effectively. It's really fantastic. What kind of reactions are you getting from people about the books? Do some say it's sacrilegious or blasphemy? It's somewhat controversial subject matter.
Well, the subject matter is controversial in that I'm taking, you know, a sacred text, the Bible, and creating fiction with some of the characters, Jesus in particular. And so, I mean, people have all sorts of beliefs I've learned, and I respect them, you know. I mean, until we're actually there or see God, you know, who can say for sure? So I respect people's beliefs. But I think a nun reviewed the first book, and she wasn't very pleased. You know, she liked the story, but what I write is people as we are. I just absolutely am determined to do that. Not as any religion says we ought to be, but as we actually are. I think, you know, if there was a God, he made us, he made our bodies, he made our instincts, he made everything, and I'm thinking he knew what he was doing. So I'm going to follow suit. I'm not arguing with him. So I write us as we are, believers, non-believers, good people, bad people, you know, they're all in there, the sinners, the saints, the people who hate sex, the people who love sex, everything. I just love life. I tell you, I love people. If I could travel the world and look at every face, I absolutely would. And so I want to do them justice in my novels, in all our variety.
You certainly have. So with all that in mind, are you planning another book?
Another book has planned me.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's called The Covert Messiah. I've just finished the first draft. I malingered and delayed. This is a book I have avoided from the first because it's obvious. The concept is the clone is an adult and he's interacting with the modern day world. Ha! I avoided that like the I wrote everything else. And then that second Hollywood producer I was talking to you about suggested, he said, well, why don't you write that? I said, oh, because I do want to feel, because the subject matter deserves, even though it's a novel, even though these are thrillers meant to entertain, I do feel compelled to treat the subject with some kind of authenticity, and I just felt totally incompetent. How do I write Jesus today? Then by coincidence, at about the time he suggested this, I started a serious program of meditation. I'd been meditating off and on, you know. Everybody's recommending it now, even the Mayo Clinic. And so I started being serious about it, and inspiration came out of the ether, and now the book is here. And so sometimes I would stop writing. I was just so amazed by the book. Like I said, it's planning me, it's writing me. But it came, so I'm putting it out there. So we'll see what happens.
Oh, that's so fantastic. And tell us a little bit about your Room of Miracles.
Oh, my Room of Miracles. Oh, that's the article I wrote. Okay, I wrote an article called Room of Miracles and put it on my Facebook page. And it's the room in which I write. It's really the second bedroom. And I turned it into an office. And my husband, who is just, well, his hobby is working with his hands. He does woodwork. I mean, it just, you touch it and it feels like satin. So he and I together designed this room, and it's the room of my dreams. You know, behind me is a whole shelf, wall of bookshelves. There's a cabinet in here that it looks almost is human. It's so beautiful. And just bookshelves, lattices at the window, and there's a reading chair in here. And in this room, my husband believed in me even before I did. He thought I would be a good writer even before I wrote anything. And so he wanted me to do this. And so this room represents his belief in me and just where I come to dream. And the writing itself feels miraculous when I'm in this room, I must say, especially on the last book.
That's incredible. How important do you think that is, that everyone has that very special place to be inspired and write?
I think it's important. Even if it's a corner, you know, you can, even if you don't have a separate room, you could create a space, you know, have a special cloth that you put on the table when you're writing, put a little jar of flowers there or something, some object that's special to you, you know, burn some incense, whatever, and have a place that is yours where your spirit is free to roam and play. I think that's important.
Oh, beautiful. And I know that your Facebook page and your website just draw visitors and fans from all around the world. Are you published overseas as well as in the U.S.?
Yes. In fact, I have more readers overseas, I believe. I'm, you know, Russia's biggest publisher, just bought all three books. Let's see. Oh, you said at the beginning. So for some reason, and maybe because I do have this, you know, I love to write about places all over the world. You know, the books took off in other countries before they took off here. And so I love it. I love it when people come to my page. I wish I could see them. I literally want to wish their faces could show up on the computer, you know. And so that makes me very happy.
That's beautiful. Well, you know, time with you has just flown by, and what you've done and what you've created is so amazing. If people would like to get in touch with you on your Facebook page or on your website, can you share that with us so that they can connect with you?
Yes. My website is just my name, J.R. Lankford. That's L-A-N-K-F-O-R-D. That's F as in Frank, L-A-N-K-F-O-R-D.com. And I have a link there to my Facebook page. There's just a little, that F symbol under my photo, where you can go there too. And both books, I think, have links to where you can buy the books and lots of information about me.
Oh, fantastic. So if you can give your website one more time, because I want to make sure everyone has access to all of the things that you have there. That's so amazing.
Okay, it's J.R. Lankford, L-A-N-K-F, F as in Frank, O-R-D.com.
Fantastic. Well, I can't thank you enough for being with us, Janie, and for sharing all of this wonderful, wonderful information about how these amazing books evolved for you and evolved even into movie options. It's just been an incredible time with you. And for anyone who would like to learn more about Expert Insights, you can find all of the information about our best-selling books, our radio shows, magazines, as well as our global communities at GetEI.com. That's GETEI.com. And once again, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us. And I hope everyone listening has a wonderful day.
Thank you, Vicki.